Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Did you know that Off Camera was also a television show? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that we are a podcast, a magazine, and a television show. But what you may not know is you can watch full episodes in glorious black and white on our own website, offcamera.com. And now we've made that even easier by creating a monthly subscription so you can watch all the Off Camera you want. For only $4.99, you can subscribe to Off Camera and binge watch until the cows come home. And not only that, but new episodes pop up every week, so you can always stay up to date with the show. If you haven't yet checked it out, it's a whole different way to experience Off Camera. As you're listening to these stories, you can watch these thoughts form on these artists' faces, and it feels like you're right there in the room during the conversation. So check that out. It's a great option to the podcast, and it's also a great way to support the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with comedian and actress Natasha Leggero. How long can you continue to hear the word no before you lose confidence in your dream? Well, if you're Natasha Leggero, the answer is never. Rockford, Illinois was not a kind place for the aspiring actress. There was the art teacher who told her she'd never be an artist, the English teacher who told her she'd never be a writer, and her mother who told her not to go to New York City. As Natasha says, they aren't looking at the big picture in a small town. They're raising people to work at Walmart. Well, when she finally made the decision to buck conventional wisdom and go to New York, she was met with more emphatic no's, including one from a talent agent who told Natasha that she was too short to be an actress. Al Flanagan, I'm looking at you. Despondent but undeterred, Natasha left New York to try her luck in Los Angeles, and shortly thereafter stumbled upon the Comedy Store. After watching an aspiring actress friend of hers at an open mic, she was hooked. As she says, I never really knew what stand-up was. I didn't know you could dress cool and talk about how dumb everyone was. I didn't know you could be a modern girl and talk about your thoughts. With some hard work and a little courage, in the form of Valium, Natasha's first set went amazingly well, which was exactly what she needed after all those no's. As she explains, if I had bombed, I don't know if I would have gotten back up there. Thankfully, they all laugh because since that night, Natasha's comedy and acting careers have been on a forward march. She's the showrunner and co-star of Comedy Central's Another Period, and her joint comedy special with her husband and fellow comedian Moshe Kasher, called The Honeymoon Stand-Up Special, is out now on Netflix. Natasha joins Off Camera to discuss why comedians make the best company, why public transportation could be a comedy goldmine, and why nothing is sacred when you're in a relationship with a comedian. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Natasha.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
How do you like our white room?
Gorgeous.
It's not a hot tub.
Oh, I know. I do like to do my interviews. I've also done interviews in saunas.
Have you?
Yes.
And you're a new mom.
I'm a new mom.
Did you have the baby in a hot tub?
No, I would have loved to have a home birth and like do it in the tub.
Yeah.
Or like in the Black Sea or something. But it was, I felt like I was at the age where I wanted to be at a hospital and make sure they had every blood on tap.
Yeah.
In case anything were to go wrong.
Well, it's funny. I watched the Honeymoon special on Netflix, and you talk a lot about your family. And, you know, I couldn't help but sort of infer that it wasn't the most, like, supportive artist upbringing.
Well, I'm from Illinois.
Right.
A small town called Rockford. I went to public school.
Yeah.
I remember specifically being told I was not an artist, and also I was not a writer.
Who told you weren't an artist?
The art teacher told me I wasn't an artist. The English teacher told me I wasn't a writer. It was a very negative environment.
Really?
I mean, I did not know what an Ivy League school was until I was 30. But I think in a small town like that, you know, they're not looking at the big picture. Like, the guidance counselor just wants someone to, you know, they're raising people to work at Walmart.
Right.
You know, like, it's they need people to stay in the town and work these kinds of jobs.
Yeah, I wonder if your art teacher thought, I'm doing her a favor. I'm telling her she doesn't have to have some silly dream of being an artist.
Well, what the art teacher did, and I actually am a good visual artist. I like to paint and draw, but I didn't understand perspective. And so I remember her just saying, I think you should just not take art. But, you know, perspective is very specific, and it's mathematical, and it's hard, and I, you know, maybe it wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard as a mother now to think of, like, a teacher saying, like, you're not an artist and you're not a writer.
When you grew up, was your whole town sort of the same in terms of income level?
I definitely didn't know anyone with a nanny. Like, right now I have a nanny. And, I mean, I want her to be my nanny, too. I mean, I love having this woman around to, like, help me with the kid. But, like, now I'm thinking about it, I'm like, I did not know anyone with a nanny.
Right.
I didn't know what a Jew was. Like, I remember I was in third or fourth grade, and all of a sudden, you know, three of the kids at Christmas time had to go wait in the hall while we would, like, sing Christmas carols.
And
I didn't know why they would. And then finally I was like, oh, those are the Jews. But, like, no one ever explained that to you. It just wasn't a very open-minded place.
So,
you know, like, now you would say, like, now these people are Jewish, and they're going to celebrate their holiday.
Right.
And, you know, but, yeah, it was just like, oh, like, it was they were being punished or something.
So, in other words, your surroundings sort of mimicked your own life. It wasn't like you were from the bad side of the tracks or...
No, not necessarily, no. I mean, there was obviously different levels.
Right.
I worked, you know, I mowed lawns and worked at the grocery store and had a paper route.
Oh, you did?
I did, like, everything.
And so, from, like, what age?
Probably 12 or 13.
Oh, really?
So I had, like, millions of jobs. And I, like, babysat my brothers and, you know, helped to raise them and cooked and cleaned and ironed. And I think that's why I waited so long to have a baby. Because I was like, I am not interested in any of this.
Yeah, I think one of the big surprises for me is that now when my kids come home with sort of complicated homework, I remember how much I hated homework.
Me
and now
too.
I have to do it again.
Can't you just have the nanny do that?
Is that why we don't have a nanny?
Or a tutor?
Well, I suppose you can get a tutor.
I can't help them with math.
I know, right?
I can't even draw perspective.
Yeah, because you're not an artist. Well, okay, so when your parents were split up, right?
Yes.
How old were you when they split up?
Like 5.
Oh, so you were pretty young.
Was your mom working?
And
my mom was working full time, and I was kind of helping, you know, with the kids.
Were you
my
the
two
oldest?
Brothers. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have memories of your dad being in the house? And
I just remember him with his cleaning on his back being like, bye, kid. And I was like, where are you going? And he was like, I'm going to leave for a while.
And that was it?
Yeah. Is this too serious?
That's sad. No. No. But it's sad.
I mean, it's sad, but then it's like, you know, you think about raising your own kid and you want to, like, boost them in every single way. But then it's like, well, maybe they won't be an artist, because I think a lot of things... You know, it's important to have all these, like, struggles and things happen to you that you have to... It helps you at least build strength. You know, if you think about the kind of industry that we're in, you know, imagine if people always told you how great you were and loved you so much and you just never had any sort of hardships and everyone told you you were an amazing artist and then 20 people tell you no in 1 week, you'd probably be pretty broken. But if you, from the first time you can remember, have been like, oh, I guess that's bad. I guess that's bad. Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
You know, then it's like you kind of, unless you're like really lucky, I do think you kind of have to have a jaded quality to your life a little bit, or at least that's what I found. But I remember I told my dad I wanted to be an actor, and he was like, I could see you as the next Vanna White. Go get him. Like, he didn't even understand. He was like, you'll be turning letters in no time on a game show. You know, so it's like sometimes you have to steer your own ship.
Right. Sure, there's both sides of it, because obviously it would be nice to have a little bit of understanding of what
someone
the industry
you could
was.
Ask some advice. You know, if you can't get advice from your parents, you know, you kind of... I had no idea how it worked. Like, I lived in New York for 5 years, and I remember a soap opera actress came in, and I had seen her on TV, and she came in and ordered a drink.
So you were waitressing.
I was waitressing in a cat suit at the whiskey bar.
Really?
And I came, and I got down on my knees, and I said, will you please, please, please give my headshot to your director? I'll do anything. And she was like, sure, just send it to CBS. You know, and she told me, and I was like, thank you so much. Like, I just...
And that was your connection.
I mean, I was just, like, throwing things. I had no idea. I just knew I wanted to be an actress. I didn't know how to do it. And so I was just, like, taking stabs at anything that I could.
Oh, my God. So when did that sort of hit you, like, that you... realized, oh, I like to perform, I like this.
Well, I was a child actress.
Oh, you were?
Yes.
Like an actual working
Not a
child
star, a child actress. So I was like, basically there was a regional theater
okay.
in Rockford. And so I, you know, my mom had put me in some acting class. They're like, we need a girl for something. Could she do it? And I came and met with the director. And it was like half, I don't know if you know what regional theater is, but it's like half community, half professional. So these professional actors would come in from Chicago, and then they'd kind of fill it out with the community, and they'd all right. come together, and they were all in equity, and they would all get paid, and I kind of worked for free. But I did get to like leave school. So I wouldn't be in school for like, you know, weeks out of the month, and I was always like doing the, like I would get to do Wednesday matinees, and I
had
rehearsals every evening. So I was kind of like in the theater my whole life. And, you know, we got to do long runs of shows. I got to do Shakespeare. I got to, you know, I did A Christmas Carol every year. I did Inherit the Wind. Like, you know, just like lots of plays that, you know, regional theater.
Right.
And yeah, so then I just knew I wanted to do it because it was way better than being at home.
Oh, was it sort of an escape for you?
I think so. And
yeah.
So I had a really strong connection to it. So I was just like, I have to do this. This is, you know, and I'm really lucky that I was able to find it because
right.
I guess I'd be working at Walmart if my mom hadn't put me in that class.
Well, when you were doing that, were you sort of aware like, oh, I like the equity people, they get paid and I like, would you talk to them and ask advice or?
One thing I definitely was hanging out with them, but one thing I noticed about them, I was always like, oh, actresses, because they were kind of all poor.
Right.
Or like struggling.
Sure.
And I just remember thinking like, actresses don't have very good style. I don't know if I can be one of those. Like, they sure don't dress very well. You know, because they were all just like probably making like $200 a week or something.
Right.
But definitely, yeah, I mean, they would give me advice.
When you were younger, did you know you were funny or were you quicker than other people?
I was obnoxious, loud, always in the hall, you know, like for being too loud and annoying and rude. So there was that. And then I also would notice that people would laugh and I didn't understand why.
Really?
So that was like a thing. Like I wasn't trying to be funny.
Right.
But I was like, why is everyone laughing? This is just what I think.
I mean, I wonder if there's a trait that you could look back now and point to how you were as a kid and go, oh yeah, it makes total sense. I became
a
comedian.
Well, I'm small. And so I think that people who are short and want attention, you know, they sometimes are louder and, you know, trying to get, you know, you're a tall man, so you don't know, but being
I was short for so long.
Really?
When I graduated high school, I was 5'8".
Really?
I grew 5 inches, 6 inches after high school.
After high school?
Yes.
I've never even heard
of
that.
It was horrible. And my sister is 4'11".
That's how tall I am.
Are you really?
And I know every actress that's 4'11".
You do? All
well,
three
not,
of them.
I know. There's Salma Hayek, I think, is 4'11".
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher was 4'11". I think Judy Garland was 4'11".
Wait, Princess Leia was 4'11"?
Yes.
And a princess.
Yes. The woman from Sunset Boulevard, what's her name? Gloria Swanson.
Gloria Swanson.
Because it was very important to me to know that I could be an actress and be small. You know.
You actually found evidence of...
Yes. Well, because I almost got this agent in New York, as I'm sure you know. Like, I lived in New York for 5 years, but
right.
I'm sure you know it's very hard to make it anywhere in New York. Like, when you're struggling, like, because there's so few jobs.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, there's, no one knows what to do. There's so many actors there. And I almost got this agent, and I had gone to, like, 3 interviews, and I killed my audition. I did something from, like, Balm and Gilead, and I was crying, and they were like, oh, my God. And they're like, come back one more time. And then finally the guy was like, okay, call me tomorrow at 3 o'clock, and we'll have our final decision. And so I was like, okay. So I called him from a payphone in New York, and he was just like, yeah, you know, I was thinking about it, and I think you're just too short to be an actress.
That's horrible.
I know. And I just remember his name was Al Flanagan.
Al Flanagan.
He's still not an agent. And I crumbled in the middle of New York. Like, I was on the Upper East Side at a payphone, like bawling on the floor. I was very dramatic. Just bawling on the floor, heaving, like, because I thought this man knew. And so
you thought he had the information.
Yes.
And if he rejected you, that was like...
Exactly. Well, I just assumed...
The whole town.
Yes. So I just thought he knew more than me. And he was like, you know, there's some anomalies like that. But,
right.
you know, for you, it's probably just, it's not going to happen. And we all agree here at the agency.
Really?
It was like an awful, heartless, thoughtless thing to tell, like, a 21-year-old, you know, trying to be an actress.
It's horrible. I mean, you have this teacher telling you you're not an artist because they look at one drawing.
And they're an art teacher in Rockford, Illinois. I mean, yeah. What do they know? They're
you're not an artist
either.
Right. And then you have Al Flanagan going, you're not tall enough to be an actor.
And then I have my dad telling me I could be Vanna White.
Yeah. And you were like, okay, but I can't reach the letters.
I can't reach the letters. yeah, so it's like, but I do think that, like I said, it definitely toughens you up.
And I don't mean to make light of that, because that's a huge thing. I mean, because I agree with you that having something to push against as an artist, having resistance and struggles, that's a huge part. But I also think that when you have very few avenues to any kind of success, and someone comes along and says, you're too short or you're not this, you can't find another opinion because you just don't know anybody.
Right.
And if you don't have support at home.
Your friends are like underneath you.
Yeah, so they're like, if Al Flanagan says it, it must be true. I mean, listen to him. He's Al Flanagan.
I mean, I feel like my whole time in New York was just like, you know, kind of a sad, you know, I guess I'll leave that. I guess I'll start. I mean, I literally was pounding the pavement. I would be like, take my headshots. I lived in Harlem and I'd like take the subway.
You lived in Harlem.
And then just start like walking down the street where the agencies were and like, you know, oh, hi, can I drop off my headshot? You know, I did that for a couple of years.
So you didn't have anybody, you didn't have anybody in your corner.
No.
So when you did decide to go to New York, though, that must have been a big deal.
I really wanted to go to Juilliard.
Okay.
So when I was like 13 or 14, I was very confident. I was like the star of this theater. You know, I was the child that they would always cast in any play that needed a child. And then sometimes they would like create a part for me, like where I'm like, you know, dancing around or singing or, you know, in like some kind of Shakespeare play or whatever. So I was like very confident. And then I was like, I'm going to go to Juilliard. And I remember I sent them my picture and I was like, I'm probably just going to get in from my picture.
Yeah. Why not? Your picture in the credits from Rockford?
So I was pretty sure that was going to happen. And then I had to audition, of course, and I did not get in. And I was pretty, again, I probably started bawling, very heartbroken. And then I finally, you know, it was time to go to a college, and I auditioned for all these colleges. And then Illinois State University gave me a scholarship, so I went there. And then after 2 years, I was like, I can't take this anymore. I need to get out of here. And then one day in backstage, I saw that the Stella Adler Conservatory was like meeting people in Chicago. So I was like, okay, this could be my ticket. And then I went to Chicago, auditioned, somehow got in, and then got to go to New York.
So, oh, wow. And was your mom like?
She was like, don't do this.
Oh, really?
She was like, it could be, because she was worried. I think she was scared for me to move to New York. But
right.
that was like an actual turning point in my life, because I remember my mom saying, I don't think you should do this. I think it could be very scary, you know? And then I was like, well, I'm going to do it. And then it ended up like starting my whole life. And it was a good thing to happen to me, because I was like, oh, they don't always know. Because I think when you're young, you're like, oh, I have to do what my parents tell me to do, you know? But then being able to know, like, oh, I'm responsible for my own destiny. And, you know, even if someone says it's a bad idea, maybe they don't really know. Maybe I know.
So when you were in New York, did stand-up ever cross your mind?
Never.
Never?
Not once.
Because, I mean, it's like there's comedy clubs there, and there's Saturday Night Live, and there's improv and all that stuff.
I think with comedy has, like, waves. And I think there was, like, you know, a boom in the 90s of alternative comedy. And then, you know, when I started in L.A. in 2002, stand-up comedy wasn't very popular. People weren't doing it to, like, get rich or have. I remember when I started comedy, the manager I was working with at the time was like, yeah, people just don't get TV shows anymore from stand-up. You know, now it's like every single person I know in stand-up has a TV show.
Right.
I could list 35 people or, you know, 50 people probably who, and people now, it's like they've been doing it for 2 years and then they get to be the showrunner of their own TV show. You know, it wasn't like that when I started and when we all started in, you know, the early 2000s. So my point is, it wasn't that popular.
Right,
so it's
right.
Like, to me, a stand-up comedian, when I was living in New York in the late 90s, I thought they were like, had to wear, you know, they wore a suit and talked about their wife.
Right,
like, that didn't seem like a cool thing to me. I was into music and I wanted to be an actress. I mean, I'm not sure what kind of actress I wanted to be, but then when I moved out here.
Did you move out here to be an actress too?
Yes.
You did. So you're like, forget New York, Al Flanagan's there.
I couldn't get an agent in New York. And I think that I just had this like burning desire. And I was like, I need to make this happen. It's not happening here. I tried for 5 years, so I'm going to move there.
So never in the 5 years did you sort of like think I should just quit?
No.
That's kind of amazing. I mean, what made you keep going?
I knew I had talent. No, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like, you know, you just have a desire.
Yeah.
It's different now. I feel like it's actually easier to make it now, especially in comedy.
Because well, there's more places to make it too.
Tons of network.
Yeah.
You know, I think it did used to take 10 years, that famous quote, where it takes 10 years, but it actually doesn't anymore. Because I definitely know people who are very successful who have not been doing stand-up for 10 years.
Well, tell me how you found it.
Well, I moved to LA, and then I saw this girl that I knew, funnily enough, from Stella Adler, who was like the year above me. And she was like, yeah, I'm doing a show at the Comedy Store.
How tall was she?
She was tall.
Okay.
But I was like, okay, I'll go check her out. And I saw her do stand-up, and I was like, oh, you could just like talk. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know you could like dress cool, talk about how dumb everyone was. Like, I didn't know you could just be like a modern girl, just like talking about your thoughts. And I majored in theater criticism in college. After I went to Stella Adler, I got my degree from Hunter to please my mother, to fall back on. And, you know, theater criticism, criticism in general, really, you really start to like sharpen your critical thinking skills. And
oh,
so
yeah.
You start to kind of, you know, just, comedians are pretty critical, I would say.
Totally.
You know, you're like basically looking at things and critiquing them, critiquing society. So I saw this girl on stage that I knew, and I was like, I knew she was an actress, and now she's able to do this. And so I was able to put the pieces together. And then I started doing it. And I took this class. This guy, Adam Barnhart, taught a comedy class. And he just like, his whole way of teaching was like, just talk.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we would like, you know, each class we would get up and it was all going towards a performance. You know, like May 3rd is your performance. And I was like so stressed out. I couldn't believe I was doing it. I was like, I'm just going to do it once. You know, and I locked myself in my apartment at the time. And I had this boyfriend who like kept wanting to hang out. And I was like, no, you can't see me. I'm not seeing anyone. And I remember he was like putting, you know, food for me in the tree. I was like, no, stay out. Because I just, there's something in me that knew.
Wait, he was putting food in
a
tree?
He like wanted to see me. And I was like, no. And he's like, well, I'm going to leave you stuff in. I just remember he was like, I was being.
You.
He was a loser. But I was being very strict with my space. Because there was something in me that knew I could only do this if I like became like a bubble and like I literally locked myself in my room for I think 2 days and I just made a list of anything I could talk about and somehow cobbled together this set and then I went on stage.
Was this like an open mic?
Well, it was like it's what they call a bringer show.
Okay.
So it's actually a very supportive room because it basically means I didn't bring any friends. I think that boyfriend came, but you
he
know,
was putting food in the audience.
But it's a show that's full of like, you know, you have to bring 10 people and they have to bring 10
right.
people. So all your friends are there and it's like a really good crowd. But I went up and I didn't think people were gonna laugh. And it was the most amazing set. I was so nervous my hairdresser gave me a Valium. So I remember when people started laughing, it felt like waves, like washing over me. Like it was an out of body experience.
So your first set, you were on Valium.
I know, because I was like, why doesn't it ever feel like that anymore? And I was like, oh, I was on drugs. But it was such an out of body experience that I was definitely like hooked. Like if that hadn't happened, I never would have done it again. Because I didn't really
want... Was that true?
I wasn't dying to be a comedian. But it was like, I just couldn't believe they were laughing at things that I had come up with, you know, from my head.
I think we're learning something here, which is when you try something new, take some Valium, and then it'll be like, that was a great experience.
And it was like a half a glass of wine with it. So maybe that was like... It's part of the combo.
The perfect cocktail for the first time you do a stand-up show. Do you remember sort of the first bit you did that
mm-hmm.
really got laughs?
I remember I was very mad when I was calling the woman at Verizon.
Okay.
She'd be like, it's a great day at Verizon. How can I help you? And I was like, hi, I'd like to talk to you about my bill. And she was like, what happened? And I was like, what happened? What do you mean what happened? What happened? That should be reserved for, you know, if something happens to you. Like, what happened? Why are you all bloody? What happened? Like, I would just get very mad at, like, if people weren't living up to my
right
standard of how I thought everyone should act. And so that was a big bit.
and that came from
real experience. And that just came from being like, overeducated and like, not right. I went to college for 9 years. And then I moved to LA and like everyone just seemed like dumb to me. I don't know. and hence
this career in stand-up. You know, everyone's dumb. I'm going to go up and make fun of them.
Well, the problem too is like a lot of people moved to LA from like their, they didn't go to New York first.
Right.
They
right.
like came straight from Michigan or straight from, you know, Florida or whatever it is. And so it's like people don't, I just thought there was like a little bit of a disconnect. Like
right.
I talked to like 5 girls who had never heard of vaudeville. Like people just didn't know what things were. And I'm like, wait, you're trying to be an actress? Like what's your, you want to be a performer. And I would work at this bar and these girls, oh, that was another joke. Because these girls would come into the bar and they would all want to be performers, but they would like all talk like this and they would, you know, and then there was something, what do they do? Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I just remember like being so annoyed at all these actresses that would come in and they would just, you know, just have this sort of like, I don't know, blase.
No, I get it. And I grew up
I can't
up
believe
here.
You made me do my old bits. I don't even remember them.
No, they're good. I can
they're
see.
Missing like pieces, but I just remember like the part that everybody liked.
Well, when you came back and started thinking about it, did your art criticism brain take over, and did you immediately start going, oh, what worked and what didn't? And
yes. Also, life became kind of harder because anything interesting that happened, I was like, I gotta write that down. And so your whole life just started being like, I was like, wow, this is like a different way to live. You're like living in a way where it's like anything that happens to you is like potential material.
Right.
I'm sure that annoyed everyone around me too.
Yeah.
But, you know, things that would annoy you. And then another thing, you know, you start going to comedy clubs and the people that I met and all the stand-ups, a lot of them I'm still working with now.
Right.
But, you know, they would give you advice. And I remember someone told me, like, pay attention to what people laugh at in conversation when you're talking, because sometimes that's a clue. And then I remember it was like, I don't know, maybe like 2 years in, a friend of mine who wasn't a comedian, he was like, maybe you should like dress up on stage. He's like, because then you wouldn't just be some like Silver Lake bitch, you know, you would be like more of a character. And then I started
right.
seeing, oh, if I like dress up a little more, I can get away with more. And then when I would act even more snobby, people would laugh. And I was like, oh, maybe I should.
So a bit of a character
into that
or a persona.
And yeah, you just, it kind of like finds you.
Right.
You know, and also I'm talking like going up 7 times a week. Like this was, you know, I had a little journal and a schedule and I was very ambitious about it. And I would definitely like not a week could go by where I went up less than 5 times. And I mean, I would take a bus to Santa Monica and perform at an ice cream parlor on Sunday afternoons. Like there was like shows you could go to, open mics like every night and every, you know, certain days. And
I'm curious if that process that you developed for writing is still the one you use now.
I mean, if I want to write more jokes, I have to, which I do. It's hard because then all of a sudden you start to get busy and then all of a sudden you have an assistant helping you go to the grocery store and now you're not getting to see all the crazy things that happen at the grocery store.
Right.
And, you know, because you're like running a show and now you're a showrunner and it's like, well, that's not relatable. You
yeah.
know, I mean, that's why it was really great for me to become pregnant, because I was like, oh, now something's happening to me that I can react to.
Did you get pregnant just out of material?
No, I got pregnant because my husband wanted a baby. Probably a worse reason.
It's definitely less feminist.
But when I wrote my first material, what I did is I would wake up every morning. I didn't have dogs or baby or a husband, and I would, you know, walk to Starbucks.
Or an assistant.
I would take my spiral, walk to Starbucks, sit down, order coffee, and make myself write for 2 hours.
You would?
Every day.
Are you literally sitting down and are you journaling or are you writing?
What I would do is I would have like topics saved.
Okay.
You know, like the girl who was like, you know, thank you so much. Can I have a vodka tonic? And like, I would just think about this girl and like how annoyed she would make me. And then like what, you know, what happened? What's the part of the joke? What, you know, and you would, I would just kind of brainstorm.
But you have to be able to organize your thoughts in a way of, you know, well, she says that and that's funny, but how does that get set up to deploy?
And how does it connect to other
yeah.
things that you're saying? And
yeah, and I'm curious how you train your brain to do that, and if that's just literally trying and failing and trying and failing. Or
you have to go up a lot.
You do.
And you have to see, and then a lot of times people will laugh at the thing that wasn't even the joke, And then you're like, oh, yeah, I guess that is funny about it. I didn't even realize that's the
right.
That's a funny part. And also, you know, your overhead's not very high. You need to come up with $600 a month for your rent. You know, you have a waitressing job. It's like life is kind of simple and easy. And easy in the sense that, like, you know, you're not having to, like, raise a child
sure.
or take care of anything else or be married or
have... You have the headspace to...
You have the headspace, and then you just kind of... I mean, I miss those times.
You do.
And then when you see your work pay off, like when I did The Tonight Show for the first time doing stand-up on it...
What was that like?
I was very nervous, and I remember Jay Leno came... And I've done so many late-night appearances. I think I've done them all. And Jay Leno is, I think, the only person who comes to your room every time. And, you know,
oh, really?
He talks to you. Yeah, and then I remember he came out before I went on stage when the cameras weren't on to the crowd and was like, we have a comedian coming. I want you guys to be really nice to her. You know, and he just kind of set the stage for me a little bit. And then when I came out there, I had worked on the set so much that it was just like, it was one of those times that probably a rare, you know, one of those rare times where, like, everything's just sort of, like, comes together, you know, and every bit worked in the exact right way. And, you know, it just came from hard work, I think, and, you know, the opportunity to get to be on The Tonight Show.
Right. And no Valium in that one.
And no Valium. Drug free. Maybe I had like a little bit of tequila. I don't know.
That, I would think that would be one of those like trials by fire that a comedian has to go through, like a first appearance on something that you never, that you always watched as a kid as like the unattainable thing.
Right.
And then you're there.
Yes. And then you're like, now I want to be there. So it's like ambition is kind of vicious that way, because as soon as you do one thing, then you want to be the next thing, and you're like, oh, what about those times?
Right,
you know?
Right. But so I'm assuming there had to have been something where you went up and had the exact opposite experience where it didn't go well.
The second appearance.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was so cocky. I was like, oh, my God, I'm like a star. I can't believe how great that was. Like, it was like the most amazing thing that had happened to me.
Right.
And then I went home, and then I booked another show, and I was like, oh, I can't believe I'm already on my path. And then I remember I knew what my show was. What the next show was going to be after that one. So I was like going to end my set with like, I'll be at the blah, blah, blah on April 15th. Thank you. Good night. And I ended up going to the show, my second performance. I bombed horribly.
Really?
Oh, it was just like, I was trying to riff and I told, you know, there was like these like motorcycle guys there in the crowd. It was like at a bar. And I was like, it smells in here. And then, I don't know, then they got mad and it was just like not a good show. No laughter. But I do remember coming home afterwards and just laying on my bed, not upset really, but just thinking like, oh, okay, this is going to take a while.
Oh, really?
But if I would have had that show first, I would have never gone up again.
Isn't that funny? Just the one experience was enough to like make you want that thing.
And I also thank the Comedy Store because my first appearance was in the Belly Room, which Mitzi Shore, who just passed,
right.
She created that room apparently for women. So everything was coming together to help me, at least that was my experience, to help me have this like positive experience. I think that really helped, the room.
There's a sign in the Comedy Store that says, you don't have to be funny, you just have to be yourself for 3 minutes. And I think to people who aren't in this world of comedy, that may not occur to them that that's what they're seeing when they're seeing comedy at their best, right? But I was curious.
That sign really helped me.
Well, tell me how that resonated with you.
I would go sign in every Tuesday to try to have Mitzi see me. And she was kind of sick at the time. You know, she was I believe in a Parkinson's, you know, state for the past 10 years. So just at the end of her still being able to walk around, she would come to the Comedy Store, but we waited for her forever, every Tuesday. She never came, but so we'd sign in, and that little sign was there. And yeah, that's a really powerful realization.
How did that become part of your education about comedy?
Well, I think, you know, for me, I wasn't ever a fan of comedy. So I was very lucky that I wasn't like, if I had seen Sarah Silverman and Tig Notaro and all these great comedians who are women and then tried it, I think I would have been too intimidated.
Right.
But because I didn't know anyone, I was just like, oh, I can just get up on stage and talk about how I'm so smart and they're all so dumb and, you know, just do my thing and find my way.
Right.
I didn't have anything to compare it to, so I was able to be myself. And I feel very lucky for that. And then seeing that sign and doing stand-up more and more and seeing how people laugh and what people liked about me, and it just made me more and more myself.
Can you think of an example where you got personal and it really worked?
I mean, for me, it was more about things had to happen to me.
Okay.
And then I had to process it. Like, I remember I had this car that wasn't smog checked. So every, like, 3 weeks, I had to go wait in line at the DMV. And then they'd give me a little sticker. And I'd be like, can I just get 2 months' worth of the sticker? They're like, no, only 1 month. You got to come back in a couple weeks. And I was like, okay. So I had this, like, expired sticker. And I remember this cop pulled me over. My car was, like, about to fall apart. And this cop pulled me over. And he took away my car. Because
really?
It was, you know, expired whatever. And I remember crying on the corner of Vermont and Sunset, and I was like, well, can I just have my headshots? And he was like...
They were in the car.
They were in the trunk. And so he took my car, my Mustang, that was like from the 80s, and the convertible, like the thing didn't even go up all the way, and no rearview mirrors. So I took my headshots and just like waited for the bus, like crying, you know, for my bus, you know, I had to figure out the bus system, and he impounded my car. I've never heard of that, just them leaving you on the street. Like, I didn't even know that could happen. But then, you know, I came up with this idea that, like, you know, it's really hard to give the illusion of New England money when you're riding on mass transit. But if that horrible thing had never happened to me, you know, I wouldn't have been able to, like, process it and come up with that and feel, you know, feel those things, to write those things. And, you know, some people are just, like, amazing joke writers. And I think that they can just sit down and, you know, those are a lot of times they work on shows and they're just able to, like, come up with. I mean, I think that's a very, like, Harvard thing, too. Like, the writers I've worked with, like,
just
they're
sit in
just
a blank
trained
room and just come up
to
with
just
it.
Be able to come up with stuff. Whereas, like, for me, and maybe a lot of comedians, like, things have to happen to you and you have to, like, process it and then.
Right. I mean, is comedy still mysterious to you in that way?
Yeah. Because there's also, like, this little tiny sliver also of, like, where are you at right now mentally? Because that can also affect your performance.
Right.
Because I think you can be in a really low place and have a great set.
You can.
I can. I mean, I have. I'm sure a lot of comedians have, because it's like, if there's an honesty to it, you know, you're just like, whatever you're mad about, it can
right.
come out and you can maybe get it out on stage.
Can you point to an instance or a time that was sort of a big break?
Well, I think there are people who, the comedy community, Hollywood at large, kind of anoints, and then all of a sudden it's just like they skyrocket and they're like the biggest thing ever. And it's happened to a lot of my friends. And then, you know, they're hosting SNL and they're doing this and everyone knows who they are and they're playing huge theaters. And I do feel like it's a struggle to not compare yourself to people like that. But for me, it's always been like this really slow incline, you know? So it's
you
just
get to experience every.
Right. I'm not skipping any steps.
You get to see just what it feels like.
I know. I want to skip something.
But that's good that way, though.
I do feel like I remember going to an audition when I first moved here, and there were all these actors, and they were very serious, and they were in the waiting room, and, you know, they were, like, kind of being competitive with each other, and one was like, yeah, well, you know, the casting director gave me adjustments. And I was like, oh, you got adjustments? Oh. And everyone was just kind of acting all catty and weird, and then I remember, like, they were auditioning like a comedy thing, and all of a sudden all these like cool, fun people came in the room and they were all just kind of hanging out, and I was laughing and talking to them, and I was like, oh, who are these people? Like, I want to hang out with these people because they're not taking themselves so seriously. And then I was like, oh, these are comedians. This is like way better. So I think for me, one of the luckiest things is that you get to like hang out with people who are like some of the funniest, smartest, you know, interesting, broken probably, people who just like, because it's kind of how I've always processed things. I've always kind of like, you know, jumped ahead and just kind of like squashed things and used, you know, comedians are kind of the diffusers.
Right.
You know, bad things happen and you're like, wait, it's not so bad. Wait, what about this? I can make you laugh and then you won't be so sorry and so sad. And, you know, then we can like do that and everything's going to be great. And we can sweep that under the rug and, you know, dance and whatever it is, and you're constantly like lifting people's spirits, even if it comes from like a bad childhood incident.
Right, right.
So, you know, those are just kind of like more my type of people.
What you say makes a lot of sense, and it makes me wonder, like, beyond the obvious job of making people laugh, like, on a larger scale, what do you think the comedian's purpose is, you know, in our society, or the idea of why this thing is a thing?
Comedians are like these rare birds, and they, you know, they're just their own thing, and they're seeing the world in this sometimes distorted way, and they're saying the things that they're thinking that you're like, wait, I thought that, but I didn't know I was allowed to say that. And they're processing the world and saying it. I mean, at least that's the kind of comedy I like. And you're like, whoa, that's exactly what I was thinking, but they said it in the way that's funny and shocking. And, you know, they're able to like put things into perspective and then present it in this like interesting, funny way, how they view the world. You know, it helps you get away and escape and, you know, makes you laugh, which
yeah.
is obviously important.
I mean, it makes me wonder if doing the work you've done for the last however many years of having to dissect and criticize and examine your experiences, I wonder if it gives you an edge or puts you in a different category of, I don't know, being able to be in social situations or understand humanity. Like, do you almost find comedians is almost like the way that people say the word civilians versus non-civilians? Like,
yeah, it's very hard. I mean, that's why I have always dated comedians, you know? It's yeah. like, once you start hanging out with these people, it is very hard to like hang out with people who aren't comedians who are like telling you jokes.
Exactly. I think if you are okay with saying whatever you want, whenever you want, with saying the thing that other people think but they don't say, and you're not afraid to do that.
And comedians also like view things differently. You know, like I just had a baby and I feel like all my friends are like, oh, I wish I could stop time. It's going by so fast. You know, and everyone's like, I hear you, girl. I know, it's going by so fast. And I'm like, no, this has been like the slowest 2 months of my life. Like, I want that baby to be 30. Because then I feel like we could like hang out and, you know, like then I'll finally like get to know her. You know, it's like, it's almost like taking the opposite view sometimes or like examining what that opposite view is. Because right. like comedians also are really good at seeing all sides of things and being like, well, that is good, but what about this? Because this is also a side of this. And then all the people who are like, yeah, I kind of always thought that there was more to it, you know, and people can kind of relate to it.
I think it takes an extreme amount of courage to be a comedian, not just on stage, but to hang out with a bunch of comedians. But I would assume that hanging out with a bunch of comedians is exactly how you get better.
Yeah. And, you know, people, a lot of comedians are very generous with advice. And, you know, I remember a comedian telling me that, you know, until you bomb 50 times, you're bad. So then it's like, okay, now I have to bomb. And so then you start getting into that mode, like, I want to do bad, because then I'll be good. And, you know, it's just like all these different, or, you know, be funny before you start talking. How are you going to do that? So then you start thinking, oh, right, it's not just about my jokes. It's about, like, what can I do as soon as I get on stage? Not that you have to be a clown, but, like, even if it's, like, a subtle thing. Because you're there to be funny, not just to say funny things.
Right, right.
You know, you just hanging out with comedians, you learn all this stuff, and, you know, it's, because it's a, you know, comedians do take it seriously.
Do you think you are more comfortable with either offending people or not being liked or not worrying about having to get approval from people from bombing or from doing this?
I think there's a freedom in like not really caring if you offend people. But you do have to be careful sometimes. Like, you don't want to just like, I mean, I've definitely made people cry before.
Give me an example.
I mean, I remember just in acting conservatory before I was a comedian, I would just tell people what I thought and just be very rude. And I remember this like big guy from Australia like started crying because I think I told him I didn't think he was a good actor. I don't know. I was just like, I had like a mean streak. And I remember someone telling me like, you know, your words can really hurt people's feelings. And I was like, oh yeah, I should really try to be a little nicer. You know, like there is a hardened part sometimes to comedians. So, you know, I have to sometimes check myself. Like, I don't want to, because not everyone's on the same page. You know,
right.
I'll try to like, you know.
It's not a roast when you go to the dry cleaners.
I'm at the fucking cleaners and I'm like bombing and I'm like saying all these mean off-color things and the people are like, we just want to give you your laundry. It's like it becomes a it almost becomes a habit.
Right.
Where
right.
you're like, oh, I have to like always be. But you start to like learn it. And I've definitely mellowed out a little bit.
You have.
Yeah. But I have friends who are comedians who like, you know, at people, you know, comedians are very shocking.
You kind of have to be. I mean, that's the job is to, I mean, I think the reason we laugh is because something unexpected happens.
Exactly. But then sometimes, you know, I was just at Mitzi Shore's memorial and one comedian got up there and was like, she's a cunt and she didn't love her kids. And it's like, to say that at someone's
the right place.
Memorial, but right. it's like, that's what comedians do, you know? I mean, not all of them, but people, you know.
Maybe you just answered what the role of comedians in society. Like, they voice the things that way deep down we might all be thinking.
And they have the courage. I mean, I'm not saying Mitzi Shore's a cunt.
No.
But I'm just saying.
No, but maybe that's a good transition to the fact that you're married to another comedian, Moshe Kasher. And for the last couple of years, you guys have been doing this kind of new form of stand-up where it's a dual show. You go up for a while, he goes up for a while, and then you get up together. And
well, the reason why we started doing that is because the road is awful.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to travel to, you know, Detroit by myself and be there for 3 days.
Totally. And by the way, maybe the impetus was it was because the road is horrible, but you've created something that's totally unique. And your special's on Netflix now, but what's fascinating is we get to sort of see both of your styles in your individual sets, but then you come up together and it turns into more of a performance art type of thing where you're pulling couples out of the audience and sort of half giving them relationship advice and half roasting them. And some really surprising things come out. And I wonder if there's anything where you guys say in advance, this is off limits, or...
I've had that with other boyfriends who are comedians, but when I met Moshe, he was like, because something happened, I was like, do you mind if I talk about that on stage? And he was like, oh, I don't ever care. He's like, you can say anything about me. So right now I have a joke about his handicapped mother. I was like, are you sure I can make fun of your mom?
You're and testing it.
Yeah, and he's like, I told you for stage you can do whatever you want. I was like, okay.
So has there ever been an instance where, you know, you've come off stage, you're back home, you're in bed, and it starts a fight or...
Well, one thing that's annoying is since he said that, I can't be like, can you not make a joke about my body?
Right.
Because now he's got some joke about how, like, my body used to be better before I had a baby. I didn't even want to have the baby. I wanted to have a surrogate. Like, we were actually very far down the surrogate. Like, we were on Skype with the girl.
We
had chosen her. And he was like, this is weird. So I was like, ugh, fine, I'll do it myself. But I didn't really want to carry the child. So now he has a joke about, you know, something about how, you know, my body used to be better, whatever. So, I mean, I'm only 2 months from having the baby. I had a C-section. I'm not even allowed to go to the gym yet. But I can't tell him he can't do that, you know, when I'm making fun of his deaf, handicapped mother.
I think that is pretty commendable. And it brings up a question about if you think comedians are better at relationships, too. Because, you know, if I had that same situation, that would not fly in my house.
I mean, I don't want to make a habit out of it. I don't want us to be, like, roasting each other in our sets. Like, I don't think that's good either.
Right, but it makes me wonder if the other traits that go along with being a comedian, like, I think you have to be self-aware. You have to be able to laugh at yourself. You have to be pretty tough. Like, do you think that marrying another comedian had a side benefit of, you know, it was, you were going to be able to work stuff out?
You want someone who you share a worldview with and who you can communicate with and who, you know, Moshe is really close to this family, and I feel like the reason why I agreed to have a kid with him too, I was like, oh, he kind of understands things that I don't understand. Like, I feel like he would be a good father. You know, because my mom was a single mom, so I'm like, I don't want to do that myself. That seems like a nightmare. And we had, like, a problem child in the family. And, you know, so it's like, you know, I think it being a comedian helps because he understands my lifestyle. You know,
right.
It's like he can go away for 3 days. I can go away for 3 days. We can, you know, I've known people who dated non-comedians, and they're like, what do you mean you have to go? How much are they paying you tonight? And you're like, nothing. And you're like, oh, but you're going to go to the Comedy Store right now and get paid $12 and not hang out with me? You know, and it's like, well, I need to work on it. Well, why can't you work on it when you get paid? And, you know, like, they don't understand. So
the kid that was putting food in the tree never could have handled it, right?
Exactly. But so just having someone who understands your lifestyle is key.
Yeah, yeah.
To your happiness, because then you're not, like, in fights and, you know.
Are you able to try material out on him?
Yes, but I have found, and I don't know why this is, but whenever you have an idea for a joke, it's not a good idea to just, like, spit it out to a friend or to a lover. I think it's better to just save it and go on stage and try it. Because sometimes I'll do that, and it's like, why? Or like, sometimes I'll have a new joke, I'll try it once, and it kills, and then I'll tell someone. I'll be like, you should hear my new joke, it's so funny, it's this. And then I do it again, and all of a sudden it doesn't get the same reaction.
Right.
Maybe there's like a, you know, I'm jinxing it or something. But I just feel like sometimes it's good to keep it to yourself until it's like a thing.
And until there's probably that extra bit of something when
confidence,
you're on stage, right?
Right. Because sometimes you like, you know, I'll be like, what about if I say this? And they're like, I don't really get it.
Right.
Then you're probably never going to even try it. Where it's like, well, maybe you got it in a way that it might not have worked the first time, but then it would have as long as the audience gives you enough that you could try it again, then you can like slowly start to figure out what the bit is. But, you know, that's why I actually think Twitter happening kind of ruined joke writing for me in a way. Like, it was definitely better pre-Twitter.
How so?
Because I would think of something and then I would write it at the top of my spiral and then I would go to Starbucks and I would write about it and think about what was funny about it, and it wasn't always the first thing. You know, it would be like, oh, and then that leads me to that and that, and then, oh, and this should be the bit, instead of like, as soon as I have a vaguely comedic thought, I'm just like,
Let me tell the world.
Yeah, let me tell the world. And then it's like, it's not developed. I mean, sometimes they're good, but, you know, it's not quite developed. It could have been so much more. And now it's just a tweet. And then you always feel a little cheap if you, like, take your tweet and you, like, bring it to the stage. Unless you're, like, reading tweets. It's like, oh, didn't you put that on Twitter? Or you get self-conscious in your head.
And I would think living in the house with a comedian, they've heard every iteration of every rhythm of every joke, whereas an audience hasn't. Like, so I would think that sometimes, you know, that could be hard.
Right, but I would rather live with a comedian and laugh all day.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a trade-off.
Yeah. So what do you guys fight about?
Well, do you really want to know?
I do.
Well, Moshe definitely, he has never shut a cabinet. Ever. In fact, he told me, and when he drops something, his instinct is to run away. So it's challenging living with someone who, like, doesn't know how to clean up after themselves.
So you're hitting your head and tripping over stuff all the time.
Well, my head doesn't quite reach the cabinets.
So you found the perfect man.
But I do think that, because I will show him, like, look how to close, you go like this. Or like the drawer, it's like, I mean, it takes, like, very little effort.
You can do it with your hip.
Yeah.
Or your shoulder.
But he can't do it.
He just can't.
I don't know what it is. It's really bizarre. Maybe it's a common problem.
I don't know, but it doesn't sound insurmountable.
No, that's good. I would like that he... Because, like, when I met him, he was like, oh, do you want to see this Ingmar Bergman film? And I was like, oh, yes, of course I do. You know, like, this is my type of man. And so we watched that. And, you know, I kind of thought he was like this really sophisticated man who was into art films. And, of course, he has that side to him. But, you know, I think he specifically stopped playing video games for a couple years until he got real comfortable.
Yes.
And now the headsets come back on. And there's a lot of video games happening.
But again, I think that's where a comedian would have an advantage. Like talking about earlier, being okay with people not liking you or offending people, whatever, you know what I mean? Like that self-awareness of, I'm gonna be who I'm gonna be. And like, I would think that would give you guys a leg up.
Definitely.
Has there ever been an instance where you have had a couple on stage and you're sort of doing your roasting slash therapy thing, and it's brought up like a significant or unexpected development or conversation where you guys have actually learned from it?
Sometimes they're very dark. Like, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, we are not real therapists. You know, like some girl came up and she was like, my husband doesn't understand the role of father to our kids. And we were like, yeah, we're just comedians. We can't really help you. So, you know,
you
stuff
do understand
like that.
You're in a comedy show.
Right. Sometimes that would happen.
Why did you raise your hand? She's
it
desperate. That's fascinating, though, because I feel like when the audience comes up, I would think the craft totally switches there to almost a different job, right? Like, you have to become more of an improv expert or an active listener. Like, do you find that your brain has to switch to a different mode to listen to what they're saying and immediately, like...
Yes, and I also feel like what's hard for me, and Moshe and I used to get in fights with... small fights about this on the road, is I actually wanted to help them. And he's like... He would always be like, okay, there's the joke, and then want to get off stage. And I'm like, but we should be, like, helping them. And he's like, why? And I'm like, well, because. And so... You know, because I would always be trying to extend it.
He's trying to find the perfect...
trying to find the perfect laugh that we can end on, and I'm trying to, like, delve a little deeper to solve the problem.
But maybe that's why it works so well.
Yeah, maybe. So, you know? Yeah, I think we've found a way to meet it halfway, so it's like we can still make jokes, but, you know, I don't want to just make a joke and have them leave before we've addressed their problem.
I mean, obviously, I respond to both in the show, and there's some stuff that comes up that's funny, but at the same time, it's real. It makes me think of... The fact that, like, you two both seem comfortable talking to the audience. You address the crowd in your own set. And you know, I think of Steve Martin in the 70s when he took his whole audience across the street to a McDonald's and bought them fries, right? Like, this opportunity, you have a whole room full of people sort of at your beck and call. And I wonder if that part is more exciting to you in a way. Like, are you comfortable with the unexpected?
Of course, because you obviously get sick of your material.
Okay.
So it's always a little bit of a vacation when you can, like, start talking to the crowd. And I love things, like in my special, I have this thing where I ask the women in the crowd if they've ever seen a man jerking off in public. And, I mean, every single night, like, 50 women raise their hand. And, like,
right.
I just want to talk to all of them. But it's such a fun time because then it's like, oh... You know, I don't know where it's going.
That part of the show is incredible, by the way. First off, whatever is happening in the room, to see so many women's hands go up is a more effective understanding of the Me Too movement than anything else. Like, the idea that pretty much every woman in the room at some point in their life has had a man masturbate in front of them is shocking. Like,
I don't think men realized that.
No.
This is something that most women have... experienced. I'm not saying like aggressively so, but
right.
You know, at a beach or at the grocery store or wherever, you know. I mean, I've heard so many crazy stories.
No, it's shocking to me, and it puts it in a new light that it's not reserved for, you know, hotel rooms or casting couches, or it's just sort of like in the scope of your day. You know? And I think
And
that,
women have decided not to do that.
Right.
Women don't do that.
Women don't murder people. They don't masturbate in public.
They don't rape.
You guys are so boring.
I don't think there's a lot of female serial killers, are there?
No, I don't think so. So I guess I'm wondering about that, you know, the idea that's more than comedy. Like, all of a sudden you're having shared experience. I'm sure when it's magic, there's nothing can touch it, right?
Yes, but the thing is, it doesn't always get captured on... You know, on camera, or you can't always do it again.
Right.
But it is great for the moment, and it's also very hard to follow. Like, it's very hard to follow with material.
Oh, that better be the end.
Yes.
Now I understand your problem with, like, knowing how to close your set.
Right, I'm learning. It's only taken 17 years.
Well, I have one last question. I'm curious about the fact that just a few years ago, you were doing a whole set about how glad you were you didn't have kids. And here you are, you have a child, and I was curious if having a child just sort of changed your perspective enough that, is this almost a dividing line between letting a persona go even further away and just kind of following what your life is going on with?
I mean, I was very afraid of that, and I, you know, and then I was like, oh, what am I going to talk about? And, you know, I've always been so against having a family, but, you know, I decided to have one. And now I'm glad I did, and I'm just, you know, having to live in that world now. And, you know, I think I was afraid that, like, you have to become a mom, and then everything around you becomes this mom world. But what I'm realizing with the kid is, like, oh, I'm still my same self. Now I just have a baby.
Right.
I kind of feel like it's the 70s. You know, it's like the baby doesn't have to like completely change me. Although I don't think dead baby jokes are funny anymore.
That's changed.
That has changed. But at the same time, I still feel like I can be myself and she can come along with me.
Right. You're not...
I'm not trying to like change myself.
But that's, I think, a beautiful thing about what you do and knowing yourself and having a career is that you weren't waiting for that to complete you. So you do see it in a different way, right? Is that?
Yes.
Yes. Well, that's all I have.
Hopefully she'll take care of me when I'm old. What's not to love about that?
You know what? I think what I am drawn to about your work is that there's this attempt to be totally truthful. It's just sort of who you were, and it's sort of who you were, you know, back in middle school, and no one noticed, right? They just thought you were loud, and they sent you in the hall.
But well, thank you. That's very nice. That's a nice compliment.
No, I think that, you know, it makes me sad when I hear that an art teacher said you're not going to be an artist, and a writing teacher said you're not going to be a writer. And
I'm definitely putting my child in private school.
No, but I think your work is it. Your personality comes through with everything you say, and it as an audience member, it makes you feel like, or makes me feel like I know you, and now I feel like I do know you. So,
why? Thank you.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed that. I had a great time meeting Natasha. She made me laugh, and she also has a way of holding a barometer up to society, and I really like her point of view. Make sure you check out Natasha and her husband Moshe Kasher's honeymoon special on Netflix, and also Natasha's Another Period on Comedy Central. And if you want to see Natasha in a hot tub and Moshe in a really small Speedo, YouTube Tubbin' with Tash. That's all I'm going to say about that, but check it all out. And if you want to find out more of what we're all about, go to offcamera.com. In addition to being a podcast, we are also a television show on DirecTV's Audience Network. And you can find us many nights a week on channel 239 on the DirecTV Network. And if you want to have the full deep dive into our television show, I recommend our monthly subscription. For only $4.99 a month, you can have access to every show we've done on any device you'd like to watch as many times as you like. That's right, we have almost 150 shows available right now for you to watch, and the amount of advice and wisdom collected in all those episodes is pretty wild. And when I look back at what we've done over the last 4 years, I'm proud that we've managed to develop a library of what it really means to be a creative person. And I think the best way to experience that is by checking out our television show archive. So check that out, go to offcamera.com, look for the subscribe button, and jump right in. We also have a store, so if you want to support us and help us keep this show going, go to the store, check out all the magazines we have for sale. We have some special signed copies. And you can also check out our off-camera portrait book. We've made a 275-page coffee table book with all the photographs that I shoot of the iconic artists that come through our doors. And it makes a great addition to any photographic library and to any coffee table. So check that out. It makes a good gift. It's a nice way to spend an evening looking at black and white photography, and it helps the show. So check that out and send me an email if you want to buy one, and I will personally transcribe a message to you or to a loved one, and you can have a personalized copy. What else can I tell you? Well, we're on social media. You can go to Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or you can go to my personal Instagram, Sam Jones Pictures, or my Twitter, Sam Jones. And it's a great way to keep up on who's coming up on the show. You can see some photographs, some behind-the-scenes things. And best of all, you can tell the world about us. So if you love what we're doing here, don't keep it a secret. Share everything about Off Camera on social media. Tell your friends, tell your family. Tell people you don't even know. Because we want to keep doing this for a long time. And we could use all the help we could get. Also, I love hearing from listeners. So if you have a guest suggestion, or just a comment or a criticism, or you just want to send me your favorite list of board games that you played growing up, whatever, you can email me at sam@offcamera.com and just let me know how you're doing. And I also want to thank everybody that helps us out on this show. I couldn't do this show without a talented team of people that make the television show, the podcast, and the magazine happen each week. Here they are: Crawford Shippey, our producer; Nathan Shields, our editor; Michaela Galvin, our graphics whiz; Kara Johnson, our transcriptionist; Sasha Snow, who handles our studio; and Matt Davidson, who this week made a batch of his rhubarb and peanut chutney for the crew. I haven't tried it yet, but, I'll just say I haven't tried it yet. But thank you, Matt, for that. That was a good effort. And make sure to join us next week when I sit down with actress Sarah Paulson.
What am I doing with my life? I'm playing pretend with strangers, and all of these random people have descended in one evening. It's an extraordinary thing. You're going to watch people pretend to be other people, but you're going to, and there's the magic on stage particularly, where anything someone does, they can tell you, we are in outer space, but it can be a black box. And you as an audience are going, okay, we're in outer space. Doesn't have to be an intricate set, doesn't have to be a crazy costume, but they're telling you what the reality is, and you just go along for the ride, and you all do collectively. I love it.
I've loved Sarah's work since Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, and after seeing her tour de force performance as Marcia Clark on The People vs. O.J. Simpson, I was just blown away by her ability to disappear into a character, and I wanted to know how she did it. The conversation that followed was both revealing and mysterious, and got to the very essence of what it means to be an actor. Yes, you have to work your butt off, but it's more than that. Sarah had to discover who she was before she could become anyone else. And the story of that journey of self-discovery is fascinating. See you next time, off camera.